Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
Hello, good afternoon. Thank you for joining us today, and thank you for those who have invested in us to date. Today from RA, you have myself, Sarah Nahlfeldt, CEO, Lars Nahlfeldt, COO, and Andrew Walter, CFO. The main purpose of today's call is to reach out to investors on the back of the current trading update we announced on Tuesday to give you the opportunity to ask us questions, for us to fill you in, and more or less to give you a very high-level overview of the business, as we recognize some of you may not be too familiar with us. We'll then cover the key messages from the announcement we made and open it up to Q&A. For those of you who don't know who we are and what we do, well, we deliver on-the-ground infrastructure and services to our clients. We offer them turnkey solutions that allows them to focus on what they do best. So when the MOD came to us for planning a large-scale exercise in Oman, they actually wanted us to implement something that their existing contractor could not implement. We constructed a fully fledged military camp, including helipads and accommodation, offices and catering facilities for the MOD on site. We maintained it over the 4-month exercise, and we catered to all of the participants of the exercise. When it was over, we packed it up, left the site in the same condition, and handed it back over. And that is the photo you can see on my left.
Yeah, on the photo in the middle is another example of a project that we undertook. It was a key landing strip in a dangerous and remote area in East Africa, being used by both humanitarian agencies and Western governments. It had fallen into disrepair and had also been badly damaged by mortar fire. RA International was the only contractor that was able to get the right equipment and workforce to site so as to repair and refurbish the runway to international standards.
I'll follow on with the plane on your right there. So during COVID-19, as you're aware, airports throughout the world had been on lockdown. And that created obviously a supply chain nightmare for everyone. Now, despite this, we were supporting a client in Libya, and we managed to arrange regular flights into Benghazi, disinfecting the goods before offloading, making sure that the clients that we had who were supporting on the ground had a steady supply to carry them through throughout the period.
These are just three examples of what we call mission-critical support functions we've carried out for clients over the last 16 years. The delivery of these types of complex projects in remote site services on time and within budget in very demanding environments is what's developed a very strong reputation for RA for strong delivery and service delivery on time within budget. And it's why our clients come back to us time and time again, requesting our involvement in other additional projects around the world.
So let's look at the clients. We split our clients into three categories: humanitarian, government, and commercial. Now, the commercial sector is typically large corporations investing in the natural resource industries, but we also have some telecom and others in there. We started our business mainly within the humanitarian sector, where we were supporting the United Nations and peacekeeping missions in Afghanistan and Sudan and Somalia. And at one point, nearly 90% of our revenue came from this sector alone. Now, today, about 50% of our revenue comes from government and commercial. So broadening our activity in this way is one of our important parts of our growth strategy.
It's important to note that as we grow, we're really just growing with blue chip clients. So predominantly, since moving on from having about 90% humanitarian work, you know, we started to shift into the US and UK government work. That's sort of a very large part of our business now. Now, as we expand into the commercial sector, you're looking at large public companies and sort of multi-billion dollar global private companies that execute globally significant projects. We perform significant due diligence on any client we're going to take on, as our reputation is paramount. And, you know, even if it is a large multinational engineering firm, we recognize that the credit risk in terms of working with these organizations, you know, is never as good as the United Nations, US or UK governments.
It's also worth pointing out that the UN is not an entity, but it's already set up of 15 specialized agencies, you know, 14 peacekeeping missions and several other affiliated organizations, you know, the conferences and so on spread across the world. Whereas UN peacekeeping was a main customer of ours a few years back, we have over the last couple of years diversified greatly within this organization as well. And we are now supporting more than 10 UN entities.
With a track record of delivering turnkey solutions in difficult situations and environments, we turn to the commercial sector, mainly the natural resource industries, to offer similar services. The actual model of a one supplier support from supply all the way through to constructing, all the way through to providing the IFM services means we have a very strong value proposition to offer clients in the sector. And just this August, we announced our largest contract to date, which is a $60 million contract with a new client in the commercial sector. And this is a great mark on how we've been able to drive growth within the sector.
So we now have a workforce of over 2,000 people, of 40 nationalities, and we're delivering contracts in 12 countries. Since we started in 2004, we've delivered over $500 million of contracts. And this growth has been customer-driven, meaning we often follow our customers from one country to another as we're called upon to support their mandates and workload. This is critical to understanding the growth trajectory of the business and specifically why we operate in many of the countries we do. Our approach is client-focused, but we generally have a good idea as to where our existing clients will require our services in the future and start research and reconnaissance years before a project may begin.
If we link this approach to the market opportunity, our addressable market is best defined as humanitarian and Western government spend on ODO, which is official development assistance. We've got commercial investment, typically natural resources in sub-Saharan Africa. As you can see from this slide, between UN agencies, Western governments, and the natural resource industries, there are substantial budgets and opportunities that we can tap into. It's important that we're targeted in how we address these opportunities. So we've developed a research-focused, intelligence-led approach to target the customer spend within these different sectors effectively. Our track record with the humanitarian and governments demonstrates this approach is actually working, and the natural resource companies that we are now targeting are liking this approach. We have an emerging and complementary market opportunity there. We're a trusted partner to our clients, and our approach is really targeted. We actually go where our clients want us to go, so there's definitely a clear potential for significant future growth.
And when we enter territories, we obviously unlock value through our operational focus and strategic planning. So in 2015, for instance, we took a decision to start looking at Mozambique as a potential future business opportunity. So we recognized the natural resources industry's work there and the remoteness of these locations. We started by setting up a company, and then we fielded regular fact-finding missions from senior level staff, and eventually acquired a catering company in Maputo that would give us the necessary past performance in the country. Just ahead of the launch of the liquid gas announcements, recognizing the need for accommodation in the Cabo Delgado province, we purchased land strategically located in the Afungi area, and then we started building the first super camp, which led us to winning a USD 60 million contract as a tier one supplier to Total. We first established ourselves in South Sudan back in 2004. And this is another example of how we do it. We developed our business steadily, and when the civil war erupted in 2013, we kept operating an FM contract for the World Bank, but kind of downsized most of the other operations. So throughout the whole conflict, we maintained a foothold in the country through this contract with the World Bank, and that enables us to restart operations at the end of the war, and as contracts started being issued again. With the past performance we have started gaining on a US project in Denmark, coupled with our long experience in South Sudan, we were awarded a contract to the US State Department in Juba. So this is how we are being able to grow our operations and keep progressing in countries we're established. We are being invited to undertake projects in new geographies with customers increasingly recognizing our global reach. And this is, again, another key pillar of our growth strategy.
So we deliver services to our customers through three service channels: integrated facilities management, construction, and supply chain services. So while each of these is considered a separate service channel, more often than not these days, we're being asked to deliver hybrid contracts, which is what we consider contracts or projects where we deliver across multiple service channels. So we might have a contract where we're building a large facility under the construction service channel, but also embedded within that contract might be a 2 or 5 year service provision where we then provide the occupants of that facility catering services, housekeeping services, and maintain that facility. That would work across construction and integrated facilities management. We might also have another contract that might work across supply chain and construction, whereby we're procuring and delivering a large number of modified containers, and then actually erecting those containers once they get to the end location.
As Andrew's mentioned, this turnkey solutions that RA offers is actually a competitive advantage. We're frequently the only service provider that can offer this breadth of services, and it's becoming a much more sought after proposition by the clients who actually prefer to deal with one contractor rather than several contractors doing multiple contracts. One contractor becomes one management cost rather than three or four management costs operating separate contracts in the same location. Now, our success is built up on the ability to go in on, as Andrew said, a small construction contract or small supply chain contract. And once we're on the ground, we have the ability to upsell our services, which leads then to extended contracts within IFM. Our success in the market is the way we manage these turnkey solutions offering for our clients along with the reputation that we actually have in the market. So one supplier model that we've maintained now for over 16 years.
So in terms of revenue generated from each service channel, for H1 2020, construction and supply chain accounted for 30% and 25% respectively of group revenue, with IFM contributing 45%. So IFM's been pretty steady in terms of the level of revenue contribution over the last couple of years, while the mix of construction and supply chain has fluctuated. In the short term, we're relatively agnostic with respect to where the revenue comes from. And that's because even though IFM revenue is generally longer-term contracts that have higher margins, the construction and the supply chain revenue drive IFM revenue, as we see it. So as I mentioned before, you might start procuring a large number of containers, then erecting those containers, and then you can then capture the five-year service contract off the back of that. And our success in converting short-term business into more valuable recurring revenue has underpinned our significant order book growth, where our order book currently stands at $187 million. So our order book demonstrates that we're building high-quality business. The order book has strengthened considerably since IPO in 2018, demonstrating the value-added services we deliver to customers and the momentum we have. Cumulative contract wins in 2020 are over $100 million, and that builds on $62 million in 2018 and $91 million in 2019. The quality of our order book continues to improve, with 67% are now constituting IFM contracts. At $187 million, our order book represents significant, secure future revenue. And really, this is what underpins our confidence to deliver growth year on year, obviously COVID-19 considering. So this slide really shows our transition from mid-2018, at the time of IPO, to September 2020. So if you look at the type of contracts and the size of contracts we were taking on in 2018, they were generally between $1 to $10 million. We're now looking at contracts, you know, both that we're being awarded and that we're bidding on in the average of $10 to $100 million. In terms of the quality and contract order book, we used to have IFM order book of $75 million at the time of IPO. That's now up to $127 million at the end of September. Diversifying customer base, we've made great strides just in the last 2 years, where only 9% of our revenue was coming from government commercial in 2018. Now it's 53% as at September of 2020, or for the first half of this year. Customers are responding positively to the benefits of our one supplier model in terms of we're being asked to essentially step in as the only supplier of choice on many of the contracts that we're awarded. So we use the term sole source, which is an industry term, which essentially means that there's only one contractor that can fulfill the client's requirements. It's often used in government contracting, but what we're finding more and more now in the commercial sector is we're being approached on a sole source basis because it's recognized that RA International is the only contractor that's capable of both constructing a facility to a high standard and then servicing that facility once it's built. We're also expanding into new geographies. In 2018, we were operating across 8 countries and we're now up to 12.
We've always been a compliance-led company with a big focus on sustainability over the years, and we are very ethically driven because of the areas that we operate in. Our whole aim in starting this company all those years ago was to ensure that we could differentiate ourselves. Just because we're operating in tough environments doesn't mean that we should skimp on providing the best possible service that we could, from internally to our own staff and externally to the communities in which we operate in.
So we like to think that the success of our international comes from operating responsibly and sustainably. Sustainability is integral to our core business activities, and it's second nature to all of us at RA. We think about the environmental, social, and financial impacts of the decisions we make. Our approach is encapsulated in our purpose to deliver immediate results and lasting change. We chose early on to align ourselves with the UN Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, and we identified where we can have the most significant impact. Our focus areas are resource management, people and skills development, and labor rights. We create lasting relationships with our host communities by increasing the skills of our local labor force and helping small businesses become more resilient, and are continuously figuring out how to reduce our carbon footprint. Now, these efforts contribute to SDGs 4, 7, and 8 in particular, and closely reflect the developments in environmental, social, and governance reporting. To us at RA, sustainability is simply a natural part of everything we do.
Equally important to us is business ethics, and we've been championing this since the very beginning, becoming signatory to the UN Global Compact in the early 2008, and lately taking a step to contributor. The UN Global Compact is an annual report we submit and works like a self-assessment as to how we've performed against certain global criteria set up by the United Nations. Throughout our existence, we focused on building a strong focus on integrity and company values, which has created a reliable and trusted brand. These values are ingrained in the DNA of the company.
From the outset, we took a zero-tolerance approach to anti-bribery and corruption. As a service provider to the UN, Western governments, and global companies, we put in place a range of policies and procedures to maintain the highest standards. We were one of the first companies to introduce an independent whistleblowing portal through EthicsPoint. This means that anyone can report anonymously to the portal through an independent third-party watchdog any breach of policy or suspicion of wrongdoing. We would then be required to investigate, and the outcome would be audited by EthicsPoint. One of the main reasons why blue chip organizations partner with us is the fact that we hold and maintain our reputation. We believe very strongly in it. It is a very important differentiator to us. We're highly profitable. We're a fast growing business with sustainability at the core of how we create value as a company. We're a trusted partner to them with a clear growth strategy. Our addressable markets for the services that we provide is substantial, but it means that we actually have to be very disciplined in our approach to targeting these opportunities and how we actually invest in our growth. And our reputation is central to that development of our growth. Now, having said that, I'll pass this on to Andrew to cover our recent trading updates with all the numbers in there.
So I'm sure most of you would have seen the announcement we published on Tuesday. So what were the highlights? We guided to revenue for the second half of 2020 of at least $28 million, with a gross profit of at least consistent to 29.1%, which is what we reported in the first half. Performance was in line with our expectations in this environment where COVID-19 continued to impact, and overall, we'd say this is a good performance for these circumstances. The main trading pattern has been consistent with the theme set out in September, whereas IFM has shown great resilience and stability over the period, and construction's experienced the most financial impact as a result of COVID, where projects were suspended earlier in the year. And although those have now restarted, there is still significant revenue deferral to 2021. As for supply chain, that primarily now consists of recurring revenue on a sort of a long-term contractual basis, so that's holding up quite well. And we outlined our confidence going forward, highlighting our growing order book coming from the extension of work with existing customers, and a high level of bidding activity, particularly in the commercial sector, where it's a key growth opportunity for us. We tempered this confidence by highlighting that COVID remains a challenge and that it may impact the timing of certain projects commencing. Managing these risks is a part of parcel with our commercial activity. We also announced the appointment of Canaccord as Nomad and sole broker. We look forward to working with them, and we hope that they'll continue to help investors understand the strengths of our business and opportunities we have to deliver quality growth going forward.
So if you have a take a little step back on, have a look at where we're finishing as a business in 2020, we've been tried and tested by COVID, and we have adapted to COVID, and we've weathered the storm. Revenues of at least $63 million for 2020 with a gross margin of about 29% highlights the resilience of the business. 2020 has had us look at the step change in the work we're winning, and we see this in the growing order book as we exit the year. We've grown up to $187 million. 12 months ago, we had an order book of about $141 million. The IFM is actually the biggest growth story. It's representing 67% of our order book. And the nature and value of our current bidding activity is substantially changed as well when we look back over the 18 months, particularly in commercial clients. Year on year, we're creating a stronger base value for the business and a higher level of contracted value and predictability of earnings. And then when you add in the impact of securing even one or two of the higher end value contracts that we're bidding on, then I think that we can comfortably say we're confident in our growth trajectory. So to conclude, 2 years in from IPO, we've grown the business, we've transformed the business and continue to build on what we came in on, a strong foundation of growth, diversification, a strategy that's brought us to where we are today, despite COVID. And we look forward to 2021 with confidence. And thank you very much for listening to us today.
So we have a question here asking, once COVID is behind us and the embassy in Denmark is complete, is there any reason to prevent gross margin percentage reverting to the high 30s?
So I think the high 30s is probably, it depends, I suppose, on the mix of business that we have on the go. So I guess one thing that investors need to understand is it's primarily the mix of business that we have that drives our margins. Now, what we refer to the mix is that percentage of IFM construction and supply chain revenue. And as mentioned just in the presentation, IFM revenue is the highest margin, that margin work that we take on generally. And as a result, that's what we're generally striving to take on. If we have a period where we have high construction revenue or we have high supply chain revenue, that will bring those margins down. It's primarily driven by the mix. And you know, if that mix is primarily leaning towards IFM, then I would anticipate the margins to be higher than they are now.
And why the change in Nomad from Cenkos to Canaccord? What's RA hoping Canaccord can achieve?
We have grown, we've changed, we felt it was time for change and to address different market new investors. We had a fantastic run with Cenkos. They brought us to market, and we continue to be supported by them. We thank them very, very much, and Canaccord provide us with a different view of the market.
And another question, is the UK government cutting their international aid spending significantly likely to have any effect on RAI?
We don't believe so. Obviously, it's hard to second guess the government's decisions, but we don't believe so. What we've seen in the past and what we see as a pattern is a shift from UK government spending from a more broader international spectrum and now focusing more on Commonwealth spending. The military spending is also, what we can see is going to be maintained in 2021 for our purposes. So, but as I said, it's hard to guess what the government will do and how they will spend the money, but we don't see much of an impact so far.
Thank you. And just going back to gross margins again, are the gross margins comparable for similar work across humanitarian, government and commercial?
They are, yes. So it's just primarily driven by the services that we're offering and the complexity of those services.
Great, thank you. And please, can you develop the Mozambique story a bit more? Just how big might this be in total terms? And how exactly are RA seeking to maximise returns here? What is the plot of ground going to be used for?
So the plot of ground we bought in Cabo Delgado is for the first super camp that will have 2,500 rooms to support the liquid gas developments. The first part of this is obviously Total, and then Exxon has another part of this as well. There is obviously going to be ancillary businesses around this area as well, with subcontractors coming in to support the liquid gas developments. There's also mining in the area, and there's also a bit of security work coming up, seeing that there is an armed conflict ongoing in the area as well.
Thank you. And what financial metrics do you use to measure the returns on contracts?
Yeah, I think investors would be familiar with those. So we're generally looking at the gross profit on the contract, and we're looking at how that flows through, you know, if there are any incremental administrative expenses or any other expenses below that line item that we need to take on. If we have to invest a significant amount of capital, so something like Mozambique, where we've got CapEx, significant CapEx for that project, we're looking at return on cash, so essentially what is our cash payback. On those type of investments, it's generally 2 to 3 years. And those are the primary metrics that we look at on a month-to-month basis.
And when do you anticipate that your new broker will produce a research note, and will they provide the market with an earnings estimate for 2021, or with the uncertainties due to COVID, will that prevent that?
So our aim is to get forecasts back in the market as quickly as possible. We understand that's important. And our understanding is that Canaccord will be pushing to get a research report back into the market, hopefully January, but you know, by February. Our aim would be that we have financial forecasts presented within that report. But we'll have to wait and see.
Thank you. And how does our AI operate to appropriate standards within areas that are endemically corrupt when other organisations can't or won't?
Our contracts are not held within the countries of operations. Our contracts are with blue chip entities. Our UN contracts are with New York. Our contracts with any European entities are in Europe. Our contracts with UK entities are in the UK. There is no cash in country. We have very stringent financial procedures to control how we execute projects within the country, how we manage contracts. We actually have no interaction with local entities. We do our research beforehand. We have legal entities on the ground through which we operate. We set up clear guidelines for the importation of goods. We set up clear guidelines for the execution of contracts. All of our local staff have employment contracts. Finance has been responsible for setting up close to 5,000 bank accounts for local staff over the past few years to ensure that we pay them into accounts whereby they can then provide their contribution to the government themselves, their pension contribution. This is part and parcel of how we do our setup, which is why clients come to us. We unravel the bureaucracies in those countries. One has to remember that most of these countries have existing structures and bureaucracies that we are actually only operating within, but we do the research way ahead of time.
Great, thank you. And we've got a verbal question from Simon Hedger. Simon, we're just unmuting you now.
Hi, Soraya. Hi, Andrew. Hi, Lars.
Hello.
Quick question, really. Well, maybe actually it'll roll into two, probably. But with regard to winning the sole source contracts, has any sort of consideration been given, or is there a need for RA to JV with any other sort of suppliers, maybe perhaps in logistics? I'm kind of keen to understand maybe if there's anything RA can't do that your other competitors, you know, the sort of Ecolog, ESCOs out there can do. So I think that's one part of the question about JVing or partnering. And then maybe just leading on to this, on the same lines, really, of competition, really, in the marketplace, is sort of how do you sort of dislodge some of these incumbents that are in South Sudan, you know, the Ecologs and ESCOs that are out there that you're up against? I mean, competition is always good and healthy. But I'm interested in kind of understanding a bit more about the market dynamics and how you get your foot in the door.
Well, we had our foot in the door in South Sudan in 2004. Ecolog didn't exist then. They weren't there. And we also had our foot in the door then in South Sudan when ESCO had no contracts in there. We slowed out of South Sudan during the civil war, there were multiple civil wars, and we decided it was prudent to hold on to one international contract, but to reduce our exposure. At the time, we were actually building a facility for the UN in the north, and the area was right smack in the middle of the civil war. We thought it was prudent to extract, put ourselves, low profile and operate in a very, very low profile when we maintained presence from 2004 until today. Now, we're not out there to dislodge people from contracts. We're out there to provide a better service for those contracts. We recently won two contracts in South Sudan. They're very, I say, smaller contracts. We're executing work in South Sudan. That's a larger contract we announced early in the year. Some of these contracts, we are not of the aggregate that make them announceable, should I say. They're just small, but they're leaders in. Our differentiator is that we do a turnkey solution for clients from supply chain, the construction, and the IFM. Some of our competitors only provide catering, so they only focus on supplying, for example, the food, catering services. Other competitors only provide waste management and a bit of supply chain. Offering is the whole lot, and I think we are gaining a lot of ground there because we put our focus back in, and I'm using South Sudan particularly as you brought that up, but in other areas where we have a foothold, such as in Mozambique, none of our competitors have had a foothold in that area.
I can elaborate more there as well. Actually, so some of the competitors that you're mentioning there might portray themselves as construction companies, but none of them have construction in the sites or the, you know, the scale and geographies that we do, or with the U.S. embassies, for instance. I think, you know, having competitors is obviously good. It keeps us on our toes. It sharpens our pencil, and we execute better. But, you know, I think we can comfortably say in the geographies that we operate in, there's none of the competitors, or the ones that you mentioned, for instance, that have the full breadth of service offerings that we do.
And on the sort of the JV and partnering side of the question, and is that something you think you'd need to consider, or something you would develop your own capabilities if needed?
We've managed to develop all the capabilities in-house. One of the reasons of not looking at subcontracting and or JVs is that given some of the sensitivities of the contracts we do, if I use the MOD, for example, we need to be very comfortable to indemnify and put our hand on heart that our subcontractor JV partner is not going to let the client down. Our reputation of delivery on time, within budget, despite multiple changes or conflicts or civil wars erupting, is one of the key reasons clients come to us specifically as a sole provider, as a sole source contract. And as Andrew mentioned earlier, we're getting nearly 50% of our work as sole source, where they're not even inviting another contractor to have a look in. If we go in on a JV, we would have to be more than 150%, more than 200% certain that that partner subcontractor is A, fully cleared, B, can provide the services in time and on budget. It's not going to throw a wobbly 6 months down the line saying, well, I didn't price it right, I didn't look at this, I didn't think of that, because that would really jeopardize our reputation. And I think this is something that we have always put first and foremost in how we execute projects. But again, there is no need to date with regards to what we're being asked to do. If we are asked to provide a particular service very, very particular nature, we were once asked to provide x-ray support services for x-ray machines, security machines, and it was very specific, and we actually got to the manufacturer. We didn't do a JV. We hired the staff that were already trained. We brought them in-house so that we could actually vet them, supervise them, and manage the contract. And we then put them on the UN contract that required that support.
And we'll go to Timish Gupta, who's also got a verbal question.
My first question was regarding the commercial side of the business, where you would be working with mineral resource companies or MNC engineering firms. So I wanted to know what fraction of these revenues come as subcontracts from MNC engineering firms, just to understand to what extent are our revenues dependent on our competitors.
Some of the government contracts that we execute need to be executed through a United States prime contractor. And for that purpose, they would often award the contract to someone like AECOM, or various other large international contractors who are based in the United States, and then we would be the subcontractor to that. That represents, if we're talking about large global engineering firms, maybe 10% or less of our business. And then with respect to the the commercial sector, if we're talking about mining and oil and gas, that's still very, very new to the company. So we've done a couple of service contracts for mining companies in the past and for contractors to mining and oil and gas companies. But it's really the second half of this year where we've put out the announcement relating to the Mozambique contract for $60 million, where there's a global engineering firm renting our camp for the 2 years. And also with Donnacali, although that one's a direct contract, where we've won significant contracts in the commercial sector related to mining oil and gas.
Thanks for that. And you know, just picking on the Mozambique project that you just mentioned. So the Mozambique model, it seems to be a bit different in the sense that, you know, you're going in with an asset investment. Is this something which you think will be accretive to ROCEs, or do you think it's going to be dilutive in terms of return on capital for the company?
No, it'll be accretive. So this is a model that we perfected starting in East Africa in 2012, 2013. So we've had, and even before that, the company, I joined in 2011. So even before my time, the company was already having these developments. You know, I think our thought process is we could build these developments, hand them over to a customer, and they could stay in it for, you know, the next 5 years or longer. Or we could build the facility and then lease it back to them over that same 5 year or longer period. Which one is more lucrative to us? It's the second. So it's a better business model. And we talked about in the presentation about moving from, you know, being a contractor where we just build something, move on to the next project, to really establishing the space of long-term reoccurring revenue. And this sort of ties into that. So by investing in the asset, owning the asset, making sure that we earn great returns on that investment, and also that the payback period is generated within 2 to 3 years, you know, we feel as though we justify that CapEx. And we feel as though, you know, we really are able to secure quality business for a significant amount of time looking forward.
Just taking something like a 10-year view, would you say that the business that RA is in is a bit like a treadmill business where, you know, once contracts run off, you need to start finding a next place to get a contract? Or is there some kind of, is there an additive nature to it where you feel that you will definitely have more revenues 10 years down the line compared to what you have today? And you have that much certainty regarding order books and your revenues building up.
So I think it kind of links back to my last answer with respect to, you know, our company. We see ourselves as a support service provider that happens to excel in construction and can therefore offer this hybrid service model or one supplier model to our customers. We're not looking primarily for one-off construction projects. Our bread and butter is the integrated facilities management. And those contracts, if you're looking at the mining and mineral industry, are generally around 5 years in length, 2 to 5 years, definitely. So if you start to capture multiple contracts in this sector, and often they can be longer than 5 years, that will then build up your order book over time, giving you, or at least this is the way we look at it, giving you a higher base year on year with respect to the reoccurring revenue you're going in with. And we sort of look at this every year where we look at what our floor is with respect to what is the amount of revenue we're looking to recognize in the year coming from our order book. Then we also look at, you know, what we anticipate coming from contract uplifts and extensions on contracts that we already have. And that's sort of our floor, and that continues to increase from year to year. On top of that, then you have all the incremental project wins that might happen throughout the year where you can then start to even layer up on that growth.
And another question, to what extent and when do you expect free cash flow after CapEx to pick up and become a substantial percentage of your reported earnings?
Yeah, I mean, so our CapEx, I guess it's important for investors to note that our CapEx is linked to projects. So forecasting our CapEx is always difficult because essentially it just ties into if we're awarded new contracts. Hypothetically, if we win no new contracts next year that require CapEx, then our CapEx should be fairly minimal, other than the CapEx we still have planned with respect to Mozambique and minimal maintenance CapEx. But, you know, if we're awarded a large project that does require CapEx, then our CapEx will increase. I know that's not necessarily what everybody would want to hear, but that's sort of the best we can offer.
Thank you. And this questioner says, I'm full of admiration. Your profit margins are much higher than a typical UK construction business. Will they be sustained at those levels? Who are your main competitors and where do you see the company in 5 and 10 years time?
We don't really have main competitors that do turnkey solutions. That's what makes us unique in the market space. Those that have tried to follow our model do not have the bonding capacity. They don't carry the 27 odd insurances that we carry. They don't carry 4 independent non-exec directors to ensure that we're compliant in the things we do. And they don't actually have the structures that we have put in place over the last 10 years plus, if not, you know, more. Like as we've grown, we've increased the processes and increased structures. So most of the people who are trying to provide a similar portion of the services have not actually got the package altogether. So that makes it harder because we keep reinventing ourselves as we get bigger and stronger and develop the markets that we're in. Well, that's the answer to that side of the question. And the first part was again, Tamsin?
The end bit was, where do you see yourselves in 5 to 10 years time?
Well, if you'd asked us 5 years ago, if I'd see ourselves talking to investors who invested in this company and the London Stock Exchange, I'd say maybe not. But fast forward 5 years later, it's a reality. So I am still very shocked and surprised by this turnout. But where do we see ourselves? I think we have the capacity to grow. We have set up a structure that allows us to grow. When we came out, when we did our strategy in 2017, we actually got the whole team together to say, how far do we want to go? We want to go far. We want to take this further. We've managed to get into 12 countries now, from being a single country to 2 countries to now 12 countries. We're operating in 3 languages. Not many companies can say that they can do Arabic, English, and French, and using the bureaucracies of these countries that we're executing in. Our clientele are taking us into contracts. The contracts are getting bigger. They're asking us to go to some extremely far-flung corners of the earth that we never thought we'd go to, including places like Copenhagen, of all places. And again, this is something that was unexpected, but it is fantastic. And again, we're putting the structures in place to take us to the next spurt of growth. So I think that we have a long way to go. I think we have a lot more business. We've only just started scratching the surface of natural resources and commercial activities. We have a lot of UN work that we need to work on. There's a lot more countries out there that can utilize the services that we provide in the way that we do them, which is actually very sustainable. We look after our people, we hire locally, and we're very focused on providing the ESGs that we have set up from, over 10 years ago now, that the rest of the world is catching up to. So I think we've got a good run.
Great, thank you. And regarding the MTN program announced with the September interims, why was there no update concerning this program in this week's trading update? And can you provide any additional information for us here today?
So it was a trading update, essentially talking about revenue expectations for the second half of the year. And we gave quite a lot of detail with respect to how that's broken up throughout the service channels. On the MTN program, it's open, and we'll provide more information, I guess, in likely the next significant update that we give the market.
Great, thank you. And how does the large 60 million contract that you recently won split between supply chain, construction, and IFM?
Because that relates to an owned RA asset, essentially it's all rental income, which we classify as IFM.
Okay, thank you very much. Can you clarify why you recently raised funds via loan notes when you have a large-ish cash balance?
So we like to keep a large amount of available cash. We feel as though that gives our current customers and prospective customers confidence to place large awards on the company. And looking at that cash balance, and I guess going back to Q1, Q2 this year, we felt as though Mozambique was going to speed up even with COVID sort of kicking off, and our development in Mozambique was going to need to be accelerated. And we felt as a board that putting a program in place that would increase our cash in the short term would be beneficial, so as we could go ahead with accelerating that development and not dipping too far into our available cash. So you'll note that that medium-term note program is a two-year note program, which is the same term as the contract that we signed with the global engineering firm, and directly related to our development in Mozambique.
And do management find they get stretched with the increase in geographies?
We've done pretty well to date. We have a fantastic team. I think a lot of people don't realize it's not just the three of us in here. There's a fantastic team behind us. So we have a core support staff here of about 100, contracted staff over 1,900 roughly. And we put in place administrative functions to support our growth. As we grow bigger, we trigger them in as modules so we can actually increase the staff capacity and capabilities, as well as software and things like that. So our supply chain is already underpinned, and we have earmarked staff for 2021 and 22, depending on certain contracts and growth that comes along the way. So again, this is all pre-planned and structures that we kind of look at the beginning of the growth year.
And typically, how do you generate power on construction sites? If it's currently diesel, will it be shifting to, say, hydrogen?
Well, shifting to hydrogen might be a bit tricky, depending on the size of the construction sites, obviously. Normally now it's generated through generators, diesel fuel generators. What we're looking at and where we've reached out to working together with them on such initiatives is solar panels and also wind turbines, water. There's a lot of new technology in the industry, obviously, and it's one of the KPIs that we have in the company to always renew ourselves and look at sustainability as a key factor into this one. We have a very dedicated staff on this one that take a keen interest in it, and it's led by our sustainability coordinator, Vera, who sits in Kenya, in Nairobi. But all the heads of different departments and the senior management are all involved in this and looking at new alternatives of generating power.
Great, thank you very much. And that's all we've got time for in terms of questions. Thank you very much to Soraya, Lars and Andrew, and to you all for joining.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tamsin, for hosting. And thank you very much, everyone, for attending. Really appreciate your time and questions.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.